Session number 10931.
The band's real far.
But he could never really escape from the fact that he was an Eton scholar and Sandhurst, Grenadier Guards, and his father was a major general. But he was extremely fine man, and I grew to respect him. And he was a very clever interrogator. He could speak French fluently, which came in very useful later on, of course. And I was very sad to read of his death some years ago, I believe in a car crash. Well, we eventually, having sold up the Japanese dump and sent the Japanese home, the major was called back to Bangkok. I believed at the time to be sent home on leave. Shortly after that, my friend Jerry Eason came to relieve me at Singora, and I was told I was to go back to Bangkok before being sent to Cambodia. So I returned to Bangkok on the train to learn that the major, instead of going home, was being sent to Cambodia, and he asked for me to come as his wireless operator, which quite pleased me. I thought he must be quite satisfied with me to ask for me to go with him. So off we went to Cambodia. We loaded a jeep onto an open truck at Bangkok station. Jock Ferrier, a driver, came with us, and we sat in the jeep in the open truck throughout the journey, which was quite interesting. We found after a while we were travelling through vast paddy fields, being a big rice-growing area, little to be seen but paddy fields and oxen ploughing the land and people planting the rice. When it became dark, I saw the most fantastic sights I've ever seen. I'd seen fireflies quite often before and enjoyed watching them flitting through the bushes. But we came to one part where there were absolutely millions and millions of fireflies. Whichever direction one looked, were fireflies. It was the most fantastic sight, which has always stuck in my memory. We arrived at Battambang quite late at night, and we were met at the station by Siamese officials. Siamese officials who had directed us to a bungalow just outside the small town Battambang. And perhaps I should explain that during the war, the province of Battambang, previously French, of course, was the administration was handed over to the Siamese by the Japanese. So there was now a problem that the French were trying to regain control of the province, but the Siamese were resisting. They refused to hand it over. Now, in addition to that conflict, there were what were later on become the Khmer Rouge and various other nationalistic forces, and there were also bands of outlaws roaming the district. So there were many, many conflicting items of interest going on there. It was a very, very confused situation, and it was very difficult to understand exactly what was happening.
Why had Major Beaumont Nesbitt been sent there then?
I think because, probably principally because he spoke French fluently, so he could converse with the French mission that was there, and we also found that the Siamese governor could speak French fluently, so there was no need for an interpreter.
But in what way was it Britain's responsibility?
Well, it was really, I suppose, nothing to do with us, but we were sent there to report on every incident that occurred. If there was a murder or damage to property, any sort of incident, we were to investigate and try to determine who was responsible for the incident and report our findings back to Bangkok. So we arrived at this bungalow, and we then found that there was a French mission in the town, led by Le Capitaine Deschamps, and his second-in-command was Lieutenant Ely. There was also a wireless operator and an interpreter who was half Cambodian, half French.
How did these Frenchmen spell their names, please?
Deschamps, Deschantres, and Ely was Hilly. We soon found that there was conflict between Deschamps and Ely. Captain Deschamps, presumably, I'm not certain, had been in French Indochina throughout the war. Consequently, he was Vichy France, whereas Ely had been in the resistance. And the feeling between, it's all on Ely's side, between the two was intense. Ely hated Deschamps. Even in front of us, he would insult him and would not accept any orders from him. And I found it quite embarrassing, really. And Major Nesbitt was always very short with Ely. My sympathies were really with Deschamps, because he was a very refined, cultured man, and he ignored all the insults, whereas Ely was a real rough, tough diamond. And we had the feeling that he would murder Deschamps if the opportunity arose.
So it wasn't a personal thing, it was because...
It was merely because Deschamps was Vichy and Ely had been in the resistance. The hatred was very bitter. Their interpreter, the half Cambodian, half French, was a very well-educated man, spoke good English as well. The wireless operator was a Breton. He spoke no English, so difficult to get on with him. We were also amazed to find in the town was an American missionary with his wife and young daughter, 14-year-old daughter, the Reverend Ellison. I'm not sure, and I haven't been able to discover really, but presumably they'd been there throughout the war, because I hardly think they would have got back there so quickly after the war. But the Reverend Ellison was a very fine man, very dedicated to the Cambodian people, but he took a great interest in what was going on, the local politics, which didn't please the major too much. It was,
why not?
Because he felt that he was causing more trouble than good by dabbling in it, because his converts were being murdered, and the major wasn't very happy about it. But it was most amusing, because whenever there was an incident, it would be a race between the Reverend Ellison, the Captain Deschamps, and the Siamese governor to our bungalow to get there version of the incident in first. So it wasn't a fair race, really, because Captain Deschamps would come in his jeep. The Siamese governor came in a large American motorbike and sidecar, and the Reverend Ellison came on a bicycle. So he was invariably last. So they all came to tell their version of the incident, and the major had to sort out as best he could the truth of the matter. When there was a murder or killing, we had to go and view the scene and report the findings back to Bangkok. So that was our principal job there. But there again, there was a Japanese dump for us to sell up. In this Japanese dump, there was a quantity of building material. And the Reverend Ellison kept coming to us, asking for the building material, which was given to him for the purpose of building a church. And he was still there when we left, and for many years I wondered whether he ever built the church. And by sheer chance, a few years ago, I discovered. And I read an article in the Telegraph Sunday magazine, the story of Pol Pot, which was later made into the film Killing Fields, who escaped from Cambodia. No, sorry, not Pol Pot, Dith Pram. The story of Dith Pram. He escaped from Cambodia during the Pol Pot regime. And he was greeted at a refugee camp in Thailand by Ruth Ellison and her parents, who had missionary connections, who were working in this camp for the refugees. Well, I realized that this camp was not that far from Battambang. And I thought, good heavens, that must be the daughter. I couldn't remember the daughter's name. I thought, well, that must be the daughter. And they're still there. So I thought, I must do something about this. So I wrote to the editor of the Telegraph and told him the story. And he sent my letter on to Mr. Scharnberg, who was the author of the story in America. Mr. Scharnberg rang me from New York and said, oh, Mr. Bentz, that's the same people you knew all those years ago in Cambodia. And so we discussed it, and I said, well, the daughter must be about 50 now. And he said, oh, no, she's 29. The father's 55. So obviously it wasn't the same people. But he said, well, there's got to be some connection. And he gave me the address of this camp to write to, which I duly did. I received a very nice letter back from Ruth's mother, explaining that her husband was the son of the Reverend Ellison I knew. And the daughter that I knew, whose name was Helen, was now in New Guinea, doing missionary work in New Guinea. And they could tell me that the Reverend Ellison built his church exactly where it was, and have since sent me a photograph of it. And but sadly, it was razed to the ground during the Pol Pot regime. And David Ellison, the one I knew, died of a heart attack in the 60s and was buried in the Christian cemetery in Phnom Penh. And sadly, his bones were scattered during the Pol Pot regime there. I eventually made contact with the daughter Helen in New Guinea, and I could ask her if she remembered the night when they were all to be murdered. The Reverend Ellison came to us one day to say that a threat had been made to murder him and his family on a certain night.
By whom?
By the Viet Khmer Rouge people. And so the major said, well, you must move in with us. At least we have arms to defend ourselves. You must move in with us. But David Ellison said, no. If God wills it, so be it. Absolutely refused. Neither would he accept any arms that we offered him to defend himself. And there was nothing else we could do to assist him. Now, they lived in a bungalow which was on the other side of the river from us. We had to cross over a bridge, and it was about best part of a mile along a rough track to their bungalow. So the appointed night came with us feeling very, very desperate that we could do nothing to help him. And the following morning, the major said, well, you better go down and see what's happened. We had a motorbike there, so I set off on this motorbike. I carried as much arms as I could with me, pistol and so on, over the bridge and along this rough track towards the bungalow, dreading what I might find when I reached the bungalow. Eventually, the bungalow came into view, and at least I could see it not being razed to the ground, as I feared. As I drew near, I could see white faces on the veranda, and I pulled up, and there they were having their breakfast on the veranda, and David said, oh, come on in, Jeff, and join us. And nothing happened. So it was great relief. I drove back to the bungalow to report to the major. And David and his family were still there when we left the area. So, of course, when I wrote to Helen in New Guinea and said, you remember the night you were all to be murdered? She remembered it very well, of course. And she said, oh, yes, and I well remember how my father refused the arms that you offered him, and how we all prayed every night for your safety, which I thought was quite remarkable, really. Incredible people.
How did you know that they were the Khmer Rouge?
Well, I suppose we didn't really, as one assumes. As I explained, it was so confused, the situation there. I mean, all the people looked the same. How would you know whether they're Khmer Rouge or outlaws or whatever?
But did you know that the people who made the threat were communistic in political
context? Well, not really, no. No, but basically, they didn't want the French back. We were very conscious all the time we were there of the hatred towards the French. And we always had the feeling, of course, that they couldn't differentiate between us and French. We would look like Frenchmen. One time we had to go down to Phnom Penh. Just prior to this, I had terrible stomach pains, which confined me to bed. I could just manage to get up to work my daily skeds to Bangkok. I was in great pain, and at that time there was a lot of trouble going on in the countryside between us and Bangkok, so it would have been rather difficult to go back to Bangkok. And we had to pay a visit to Phnom Penh, to the French HQ. First of all, the major was getting rather worried about it, so he called in the local Cambodian doctor to see me, who at first refused to come, saying he was too busy looking after his own people. So then the major got on to the Siamese governor and told him to order the doctor to come, which he duly did, and looked at me and said, "Oh, it's constipation, gave me cod liver oil," which was just the worst thing that happened, because it was appendix trouble, as I discovered later. So, of course, this did no good. So the major said, "Well, you think you can make it down to Phnom Penh, the jeep? There must be a French hospital there." So I said, "Oh, well, I can't go on like this. We must have a go." So we set off down this rough road to Phnom Penh, all along down the southern side of the great lake, the Tonle Sap. We arrived in Phnom Penh, which I found to be quite a pleasant sort of French-style town. And we found a hotel to stay in, which was very French and very civilized. And by the time we reached Phnom Penh, my tummy pain had gone. So, it must have been constipation, I suppose. Got rid of it. So I did nothing about it. And I was left on my own. The major went off to consult with the French HQ. I was left on my own to wander around the town. I think we stayed there 2 or 3 days. And then we planned to return along the northern side of the lake, the Tonle Sap, and visit the ruins of Angkor. When the major discussed this with the French, they said, "Oh no, it's far, far too dangerous to go that way. You're rather lucky to have got down the way you came."
Dangerous from what?
From the insurgents. There was all this sporadic fighting going on all over the place. So we had to go back the same way we came. So we spread a Union Jack over the bonnet of the... it was a Dodge truck we had then. We spread the Union Jack over the bonnet to show that we were British. And we arrived back in Battambang without any incident. Well, then things seemed to be going from bad to worse. I think most of the Ellison flock had been murdered, and there was a lot of trouble. And the major was recalled to Bangkok for consultation.
When you say the Ellison flock, you mean the
his
converts?
Converts, yes. I've discovered since that he was there for 40 years, and in that time he had 400 converts, so 10 a year. Not very good going, is it? So at that time there couldn't have been very many. So I suppose there was religious feeling as well as political, as there generally is in that part of the world. And, I should have said that by this time we'd been joined by Captain Meyerhouse, who also spoke fluent French.
How did he spell his name?
Meyerhouse. Very nice chap. He had a stammer. And he had an awful job getting out, and the major, not being the most patient of people, found it rather trying at times. I got on very well. Well, I got on very well with all of them. And so the major and Captain Meyerhouse were called back to Bangkok for consultation, leaving just myself and a driver named Roxy Hart as the sole incumbents of the British mission in Battambang. And I then received signal from Bangkok to say that more serious fighting was breaking out in the area between Battambang and the and Bangkok, and we were to evacuate immediately.
Who was the fighting between?
Various insurgents. as I explained, there were so many different factions, and we were told that they were burning the bridges. There were a lot of small wooden bridges over the irrigation streams which fed the paddy fields, and we had reports that they were either sawing through the supports or burning these bridges to cut the road. So Roxy and I, all the shops in the town had closed down. There was a large market in Battambang where we bought our food, that all closed down. So we had to go back onto our tinned rations, which we didn't touch normally because the major always insisted on living off the land. So we had to set off back to Bangkok, which was 300 odd miles, I think. And unfortunately, that very day, I started dysentery. So it was a rather horrific journey with us tearing along as fast we could. At one stage during the journey, a bullet smashed through our windscreen. And so after that, every time we stopped, which we had to do quite often, we squat down by the side of the road, I expected to get a bullet up my backside. But there was no further trouble. And we decided these bridges that had been reported to have been damaged. They were very short, only a few yards across. So we decided that what we'd do would be to go over the bridges fast as we possibly could and hoped we'd be over the other side before it collapsed, which whether that's a good idea or not, I don't know. That's what we did. And we eventually arrived back at Bangkok at night with me feeling absolutely dreadful, feverish, hot and dusty. And when we got back to Bangkok, we knew that our headquarters had been moved, but we hadn't realised that we'd been moved into Siamese barracks that had been condemned for the Siamese army, which we thought was pretty awful. And the toilets were the Eastern type, where one squats over a hole of the floor. They were all bunged up. And with me and my condition, it was all very difficult. But I went to the hospital the next day and spent a fortnight, I think, in the hospital recovering from the dysentery. Well, then we were sent back to Battambang, which I thought was a bit dodgy, having got out safely on the one occasion. We had to go back again. But that was for a very brief period, uneventful. We had a different house in Battambang. And at that time, the Siamese had come to an agreement with the French to hand the territory back. So our mission was really completed then. At one stage in Battambang, when there'd been one incident that particularly infuriated the French, they sent a